Good morning, everybody. Happy Father's Day. We're going to be in the book of Zechariah this morning. Zechariah covers enough material that, and it's a large enough, it's 14 chapters, a large enough book, that I decided that rather than trying to summarize it in one lesson, we're going to take a couple of lessons to do that. While you're turning there, Father's Day, Heidi and I have found, and we've talked to the pastor and others about this, other Christians we know, that being a parent has started just really driving home some of the things that we've read in the Word of God about His relationship to us. I actually found myself saying to William one day, "William, I just wish you'd obey. I mean you well. I want things to go so much better for you. I love you." And I stopped and I looked at Heidi and I said, "Man, this sounds really familiar." And I was thinking about, you know, God saying to Israel, "Oh, that there was a heart in you to obey, that it might be well with you." And I was thinking, "Oh, yeah." But for me, it's been an interesting experience. I guess because of a fear of being hurt, I've always been slow to allow myself to become emotionally attached to people. And I wondered, and I'm often not a very emotional person. Sometimes I can be, but most of the time I'm very, you know, more analytical about things. And I wondered at the prospect of being a father. I knew in myself that I was committed to doing what was right, but I wondered how I would feel about it. You know, would I like it? I didn't know. I don't have a lot of experience with working with children. I've always been more prone to work with adults, both at the church when we were in Washington at that church, and then at the church in Oregon. Everybody noticed how well I get along with the elderly. You know, I've always been a person more prone to interact with adults than I have young people. I remember when I was younger, I said I didn't like teenagers. I was in my 20s, and I said I didn't like teenagers. And I was with my parents, and they said, my dad said, "Oh, Jeb, you were a teenager once." And my mom said, "Yeah, and he didn't like them then either." But I have found, I've been surprised myself, the great deal of affection and joy that I take in William, you know. And he doesn't, it's not like, you know, the relationship I have with, say, like pastor, where there's that give and take. You know, basically it's all just, you know, take from him, you know. You know, he just takes, you know. But I still feel this incredible affection for him and joy in him. You know, even in the smallest things, you know, when he, like, I felt so delighted when he was going around and he was asking me, he'd point at something and go, "What is it?" You know, not that clear, but I understood it. "What is it?" You know, and I'd tell him and he'd listen. You know, obviously he was really listening, and then he'd go to something else and he'd point at it and he'd say, "What is it?" You know. And then last night, I remember it just tickled me pink when he was done with his dinner. He was going, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And I'm going, "Yes, yes, yes." And finally he goes, "I'm done." And I came over and he's like, so I picked him up. That's what, every night when I get home, that's how it is with dinner. Actually, a lot of times, he doesn't even need to be done. As soon as I'm done, he wants me to pick him up. So I'll pick up his plate, Often Heidi will grab his plate for me, and I'll pick him up, and I'll come over, and I'll sit back in at my seat at the table, and she'll bring his plate over, and then he'll keep eating while I'm holding him. Sometimes he gets a little, a little ahead of himself, and he'll be like, "Daddy," and I'm like, "I'm not done eating. You need to wait." So it's been awesome. I just can't get over how happy I am. It's like life 1993 and before was like a bad dream or something. You know? 1993 was when I made the decision to follow Christ. So it's been awesome. All right, Book of Zechariah. The reason we're going to tackle this in parts is because it covers a lot of material. It's not just the length of the book, but it is full. Like, some of our minor prophets, we're like one prophecy. But Zechariah is multiple prophecies recorded. Several times it'll say through the book, "In the second year of King Darius of Persia, the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah, saying..." So, multiple prophecies. We're going to try to cover the first six chapters this morning. Decided on this portion because in those first six chapters, there's a series of visions recorded, just one after the other. Some divided up into seven, some divided up into eight visions. The author of the book is Zechariah. He is grandson of Iddo the prophet. Iddo the prophet is one of those prophets that doesn't have one of his own books, but he is recorded in the Bible. There are other prophets like Nathan and others who are recorded as being true prophets of God, but they don't have their book. This is one of the things that I was trying to get across to some people I was talking to, that they were talking about, why do you guys just pick and choose which, literature you want to obey? And I said, you don't understand. This isn't a collection of writings that anything written by our past people, this is just a collection of it. I see these articles say lost books of the Bible. Just because somebody who claims some association with biblical figures doesn't mean that what they wrote ought to be included. I have a collection of early church fathers. Some of them were actual disciples of the apostles. Some of them, actually, their names occur in the Bible. When the Apostle Paul is giving his greetings, he actually mentions some of the people that I have in my collection of writings. I have 35 volumes, I think, church fathers, their collected writings. Its original retail value was $1,000. I got it for like $250, I think. Is that about right, Heidi? About $250. Covers everything recorded by the early church writers, early Christian writers. But it's not that this is just a collection of everything written by people associated with our religion, but rather it is those books inspired by God. Not everything that Paul wrote was included. Not everything that these prophets, true prophets, wrote was included. We don't have anything by Iddo or by Nathan because it was not God's purpose to inspire what they wrote. Nevertheless, so Zechariah is a multi-generational prophet. It comes from a prophetic family. The audience is post-exile Judah. The Judeans had gone to Babylon for 70 years. They've returned. This time period, it's roughly 519 BC. Joshua is the high priest, and Zerubbabel is the governor of Judea. You know, that's a pretty nice situation for them, because Zerubbabel is a prince of the house of David. So not, you know, so they actually have their ruler is once again of the line of David, but he's governor under the authority of the Persians. The occasion of this book is the prophecy, you know, the prophetic message concerning the coming of the Messiah and the future glory of Jerusalem and all of Israel. He does this through several different prophecies. The theme, I wrote here the theme as being the certainty of God's word. I did that because in the introduction, God brings them to remembrance of his past prophecies concerning Israel that have already taken place. And so, you know, and he does that right before he makes these additional prophecies about their future. So it's like he's saying, keep in mind, I have been faithful in keeping my word in these things. I will be faithful in keeping these. Our introduction is verses 1 through 6. Verse 6 is where I get our key verse, says, but my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. You know, Isaiah, Jeremiah, some of the minor prophets, all prophesied about the judgment of Israel, that God would give their kingdom over to the heathen, and that they would be scattered into foreign lands. So he asks this question, you know, did not these things come to pass? And it sort of sets us up for the rest of the book, which is going to prophesy concerning their future. In verses 1 through 6, we have the introduction to the book, and it gives an admonition. It brings up the past about the fact that their fathers did not hearken unto the Lord, and they came under the Lord's judgment, and he calls on them to turn to him. Turn to me, and I will turn unto you. And then he brings this verse 6, to pass. He brings up this verse reminding them of his past prophecies that he has already brought to pass, encouraging them to trust him. Verses 7 through chapter 6, verse 15, record for us a series of visions. The first vision is entitled, The Rider Among the Myrtles. Myrtles are a type of tree. They're, personally, I'm not a horticulturist, so I have no idea what these things look like. But he sees a rider on a red horse among the myrtle trees, and he's surrounded by a variety of other horses. And when he asks the angel of the Lord, he says, what are these? And he says that these are those, the spirits of the Lord, that go to and fro throughout the earth. You know, this is an interesting picture. Pastor Weigel and we talk about this. You have an omnipotent, all-knowing, omnipresent God. He doesn't need anybody else to get anything done. But he chooses to use agents to do most of what he wants done. And so you find yourself asking why. Well, can't be because he's lazy and or selfish or prideful or any of those things, because he is the fount of virtue. He is that which is good. So he must have some other purpose in doing this. ultimately, the purpose of God is to make manifest himself in the universe. One might ask, well, why would that be necessary? You know, if you're a good man and you're choosing to do something, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to do the best thing that you can do, whatever that happens to be. Well, with God, he is that which is best. He's not just greatest, he is best. The Lord Jesus Christ said, there is none good but God. He is, as the old writers would have it, the summum bonum, the greatest good. So the best thing that he could do is to make himself known, to manifest himself. He says that the reason that we are saved and that we will inherit the universe is so that all of creation can witness the grace of God, the riches of the grace of God. So that is his purpose, make himself manifest. Problem, if you're the only one in existence, how do you do that? Someone one time, to me this is an absolutely stupid thing to say, but they said, good can't exist without evil. Yet can. That'd be like saying you can't have light without darkness. Yes, you can. The problem isn't that the other ceases to exist, but that it becomes unknown. The blind person, it isn't that they experience darkness and not light. They don't even know what darkness is, the person born blind. The person who goes blind has comparison. But the person born blind, they don't even understand the concept of darkness. For me, when I was a child, I saw something that was very revealing, and it always comes back to me about how limited we are, was there was a program about this lady who was born blind, completely blind, not partially blind, completely blind, no light at all. And this guy was trying to talk to her about color and sight and things like that. And she had no idea. She's like, I don't know. Myrtle trees. Thank you. They're pretty. I tend to call those bushes. Some of the things they call trees, you know, I'm like, that's a tree? It's like a bush. Of course, when you've seen the pine trees and the fir trees of the Northwest that go up, you know, several stories, you know, Heidi was scared by these things because if you imagine, they look like they're skinnier. Some of them are skinnier than telephone poles, and they go up like how high would you? You know, it's like a couple of hundred feet. And when the wind's blowing, they're doing this, and she's just going. Afraid they're going to come down. Yes, ma'am.
These myrtle trees were in the bottom. I assume that's the river bottoms. So that's like the poplar trees, the small stuff that grows along the side of the riverbank. So you might call it a bush, but the horses could hide behind it.
Yeah. Still looks like a bush, you know.
You know, the girl's name, Myrtle, you can always tell that it's a pretty flower.
Right.
People wanted to name their daughters
by it. Yeah. Where was I? Oh, light and dark. She was completely unaware of the concept of color because she had nothing, she just, sight and everything was just completely alien to her. She didn't know what it was because she couldn't see. When she was asked, what do you think sight is? She's like, well, I'm not really sure. I hear you guys talk about it, but I'm not sure. She said, it seems like you're saying that you can touch something from far away. She had no idea. She had nothing to compare it to. So God didn't need to create the world to fulfill some lack in himself. He was self-sustaining. He had everything he needed. He was perfect in all his glory. But his perfection was unknown. So he created the world and allowed sin in the world so that he could manifest himself. I once said to Pastor Wiley, I said, God created the world to show that he was great and allowed sin to show that he was good. And he created an audience, both angels and men, so that there would be those who could see it, so that it could be understood and that he could make himself manifest.
I find it instructive to realize that he's using these spirit beings to go to and fro for the same reason he uses us to win souls and everything else. It's not that he can't do it, doesn't want to do it, it's for our instruction. Yeah. The angels are learning.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing is the epistles of the New Testament reveal to us that the angels are learning things about God by his redemptive work among us. You know, we tend to think of ourselves as, you know, the center and end of the universe. You know, we're all that matters. But God has a whole program in place in dealing with the angels. And he wants them to understand and to grow and to have everything that they need too. And so he uses these spirits, described as riders, not because he needs them to do it, but because they need to see what he has to show them. And what they reveal in this vision is, you know, they come back and they say that the heathen are at rest. The heathen nations are at rest. And in this vision, after, you know, the writers report that they have seen that all the nations are at rest, God declares his anger at the heathen for going beyond his desire in dealing with Israel. He says that he chose to use them to afflict Israel, but they pressed the affliction forward. They went beyond his desire. They took advantage of Israel's situation. You'll remember one of the previous prophets that God cursed Edom because Edom took advantage of God's affliction of Judah to make a gain of the people of Judah to advance themselves. And God declares here in this vision that he has seen this. He's letting the people of Judah know, this isn't unknown to me. I saw it, and I'm going to do something about it. That he is going to bring judgment on these nations, and he is going to restore Jerusalem. Wow, it's already 10:30. I'm going to cover the next vision. The next vision in verses 18 through 21 of chapter 1 is of a vision of four horns and four carpenters. We tend to, you know, when you see a horned person in a drawing or something, you think the devil. That's how we associate it now, the horned person. But in ancient thinking, horns represented power. And in fact, that was until fairly recently. My brother, he's always been into art. He's a skilled drawer and such. He decided not to try to make a career of it. I don't know why, but he just went in the military, but even though it's always been a part of his life. But he had this book of work by Michelangelo, and they showed these bronze statues. I'm not the Renaissance art guy, so I don't remember. It was one of these cathedrals he did, and he did all these bronze statues scattered around like the roof or something on the outside. And I was really shocked to see some of them, because I was like, what in the world? Because I was like so many Westerners at that point, because I was rather young. Horns on a person meant evil. Well, one of his, he had a statue of Moses, and Moses had horns. And I was like, what? He had two horns coming out, and he was rather robust. I was like, hey, man, he looks pretty buff. And then I was reading in the commentary on the picture, it made comment, it said, horns in former time represented power. The most powerful animal for a lot of these people was the bull. Often you'll see these old pictures of, I don't know why, they always show horses pulling plows. They didn't do that. They didn't. People rode horses. They didn't attach them to plows. You put a bull, well, technically a steer. Now they use the word ox to mean just a steer that's been trained to pull. But formerly in English, that was the name of the animal. You know, where we say cow, which, you know, is incorrect because cow is just the female. They said ox. That type of four-legged cattle was the ox, you know, and then plural oxen. And so they would take these guys, because they were so powerful, so strong, and they would train them, you know, they'd neuter them and train them to pull. And so for them, in all the ancient world, the bull was the sign of power. And in much of the ancient depictions of gods, they were often shown with horns. Or they were shown riding on the backs of bulls. Somebody was saying that likely when Aaron made the two calves, that it was not a worshiping directly of the calves, but the calves were symbolic of being the mount of the god, that the god would ride the calf, and likely a portrayal of a bull. There's a whole thing about all these different deities represented by bulls. Zeus was represented by a bull, and Baal was represented by a bull, and all these different gods were represented by bulls because they were just so powerful. I saw one, first time I ever saw one, it kind of scared me, you know, because I was like, I didn't realize how big they were. You know, it was at a fair, and the thing was right there, and I'm just going, if he wanted to get out of there, that fence ain't stopping him. You know? But, so this picture of the horns is representative of power. So the four horns, and he says that the four horns are those who afflicted Israel. So it's the four powers that afflicted Israel. And then there's this picture of these four men who come in, and I think the King James says carpenters, if I remember right. Someone was saying it should be translated smith. Whatever. The idea is workmen, you know. Four men come in, and they destroy the horns. And so this vision is that God is going to break the power, the back of Gentile power. This has not happened yet. We are still in the age of Gentile dominance, but there's coming a day when God is going to fulfill his purpose and restore Israel as a nation to supremacy over the earth. Somebody, I was telling my wife, I said, there's so many people out there who have misconceptions about how we think about things. And I guess they just assume that conservative Christians are racists or something. And back when George Bush was president, somebody said, would you still be in favor of him if he was a Jew? And I said, wait a minute, still conservative? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, conservative and a member of the chosen nation? I said, you better believe I'd vote for him. But so God is giving them, you know, here they are. God has made promises to them in the past about their future glory. But what they see when they look around them is complete dominance by the heathen. And this is him letting them know that he is aware of the situation and he is going to remedy it. He is going to destroy the power of the heathen. I'm pretty much out of time, Pastor. I went over 10 minutes. Did you want to say anything? Or? Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for your time. Little advertisement for the Nook. I'm a book guy, and I thought that the idea of an electronic reader, I was kind of opposed to it because I like putting my hands on books. But this is so awesome. If you're a book person at all, I can carry a huge library in one thing. Huh? Yeah, well, the Kindle or the Nook, you know, I mean, get yourself a, if you like books, get yourself an electronic reader. They are so amazing. I, like, last night for $5 bought over 300 sermons by Charles Haddon Spurgeon. I mean, it's just, I have the Bible on here. I have several books of academic study. I have a couple of fictional books on here. It says you can put like 2,000 books on the thing. And that is just awesomeness. All right, let's have a closing word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Lord, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your merciful kindness to sinners. Pray you bless now and be with the services to your honor and glory. In the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.